KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
He's doing what he said he's going to do, which most presidents have not. I respect that.
How do Americans feel about the blitz of actions President Trump has taken his first 6 weeks in office?
For Monday, March 3rd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, we'll preview Trump's major speech to Congress tomorrow night.
Also, if tariffs on Canada and Mexico take effect Tuesday as scheduled, it could have a huge impact on the auto industry.
So what they have to do is build their car plants, frankly, and other things in the United States.
Later, why a Wisconsin Supreme Court race could have national implications.
And Olympic gymnast Jordan Chiles on how she almost quit the sport.
My idol, who I'm rooming with, just told me that I have the potential and the capability of making an Olympic team, so I should really go for that.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump was joined at the White House today by the CEO of TSMC, the world's biggest semiconductor manufacturer. As NPR's Asma Khalid reports, the two men announced the Taiwanese chipmaker plans to spend $100 billion in the U.S.
The president said this new investment will go toward creating five new fabrication facilities in Arizona, which has become a hub for American chipmaking.
It's a matter of economic security. It's also a matter of national security for us.
Semiconductors are used in everything from cars to artificial intelligence. TSMC has now invested a total of roughly $165 billion in the United States. Trump's Commerce Secretary noted that the company had received a $6 billion grant from the CHIPS Act that spurred its plans to create factories under the Biden administration, whereas now the company is planning a larger investment with no U.S. financial assistance, just merely the president's threat to put tariffs on semiconductor imports. Asma Khalid, NPR News, the White House.
The Trump administration has raised tariffs on Chinese goods by another 10%, and according to the president, will impose 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico tomorrow. All three countries are major U.S. trading partners, doing some $2.2 trillion in business with the U.S. All three are also considering retaliatory tariffs of their own. On the part of the U.S., it marks the most aggressive use of tariffs by the country since the 1930s. The Trump administration is firing a team of more than 80 technologists who focus on making government digital services more user-friendly and efficient. As NPR's Frank Langford explains, the outgoing workers say they were focused on what the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, says it's trying to do.
The team is known as 18F. Among their projects were these: a digital tool that allows taxpayers to upload documents directly to the IRS instead of having to write a letter, and another that makes it easier to get a passport. However, over the weekend, a government official, who used to work for Tesla, told the 18F team they had to go. The stated reasons: to reduce the workforce and as part of a, quote, broader strategy to improve efficiency. One of the affected workers, who asked not to be identified for fear of retaliation, said he thought DOGE was purging the team because they had the technical savvy to recognize and check bad decisions by the Trump administration. Frank Langford, NPR News, Washington.
According to the UK's main data protection watchdog group, it's looking at how the video sharing app TikTok uses children's personal data to deliver content recommendations. Britain's Information Commissioner's Office saying today there are increased worries around how social media platforms are using data generated by the online activities of children and teens. There are also concerns about inappropriate or harmful content online. Stocks went into freefall amid concerns about the Trump tariffs. The Dow fell 649 points. This is NPR. With the fifth anniversary of the COVID shutdown approaching, a report from the Theater Communications Group, a national organization representing nonprofit theaters across the country, is offering a snapshot of the industry's recovery from 2 years ago. Jeff London reports.
The report outlines both the recovery and the challenges facing nonprofit theaters in the U.S. Using a sample of 137 companies, the report finds that the industry contributed over $3.6 billion to the economy and attracted more than 27 million audience members. Earned income increased by 94% over 2022, though that's still lower than 2019, the last year before the pandemic. Total expenses were up while staffing was down, and more than half of theaters reported a negative change in donations that can be used for general expenses. It's the lowest figure since 2009 and indicates financial strain across the field. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
As countries around the world mark World Wildlife Day, conservationists in areas including Kenya are sounding the alarm about shrinking wildlife spaces in a country where tourism brings in substantial revenues. Conservation efforts have led to some recovery for endangered species, but climate change and destructive human activity has cut into global reserves and habitats for animals. Crude oil futures prices fell 2% today to a 12-week low on tariff concerns coupled by an announcement OPEC Plus Russia intend to proceed with a planned oil output increase in April. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump will deliver an address to a joint session of Congress tomorrow. He's been in office for 6 weeks and has launched a blitz of actions since returning to the White House. So the speech will be an opportunity to promote some of those moves in prime time. Some Americans say they have concerns with how the president is carrying out his agenda. NPR political reporter Elena Moore is here to talk us through it. Hey, Elena.
Hey, Ari.
This is not technically a State of the Union speech, but it looks and sounds a lot like one. What's the difference?
Yeah, well, much like a State of the Union, tomorrow Trump will address Congress from, you know, the House chamber. You'll see similar scenes. Trump will walk in and greet people, and there will likely be lots of standing ovations from half of the audience, given folks sit by party. But the speeches have different purposes. The State of the Union allows the president to recap accomplishments over the past year. This joint address lets a newly sworn-in president lay out his plans. So that's what Trump's going to do. It's set to kick off tomorrow at 9 p.m. Eastern, and NPR will have live in-studio video coverage on our website, but you can also, of course, listen on the radio.
Okay, so those are the logistics. What are we likely to hear from the president?
Well, immigration will probably be a big topic. Trump's taken executive action there already, most notably his attempt to end birthright citizenship. That's being challenged in court. He's also threatened to impose steep tariffs on Canada and Mexico, aimed in part at curbing illegal border crossings. Earlier today, Trump said those 25% tariffs will take effect tomorrow. Foreign policy may come up too. Compared to former President Joe Biden, Trump is redefining the country's policy towards the Israel-Hamas war and Russia's war in Ukraine. Trump has expressed more sympathy for Russian President Vladimir Putin, and his speech comes just days after a contentious visit with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. But, you know, lastly, Trump will probably talk DOGE as well. You know, his Department of Government Efficiency initiative, which billionaire Elon Musk is the public face for. The administration has already overseen some drastic changes to the government. You know, tens of thousands of federal workers have been laid off. Some agencies have essentially closed. But Trump is really standing by these moves, Ari, you know, despite a bunch of legal challenges and just confusion among the federal workforce.
We've got some new information about how Americans feel about all that. What have you learned?
Yeah, I mean, Americans seem to be fairly split on Trump's performance so far. In his, you know, in the latest NPR PBS News Marist poll released today, a slim majority of respondents, 53%, think the State of the Union is not strong, and about the same say the country is headed in the wrong direction. You know, plus 56% think Trump is rushing to make changes without considering their impact. You know, but these moves are playing well for Trump's base. More than 8 in 10 Republicans think Trump is doing what needs to be done to get the government on track. You know, take Carter Dedrick, who lives in the Atlanta suburbs. She responded to NPR's poll and said she's pleased with Trump's work so far.
he's doing what he said he was going to do, which most presidents have not. I like how he gets it done, and he works nonstop for it. I respect that.
And on the DOGE effort, Ari, you know, Florida Republican voter David Nicholas can acknowledge things are moving fast, but he told me the federal government just needs to tighten its belt.
There's really no time to waste. And I feel bad for the people who are getting laid off, but it's like I've been laid off before, and nobody really gave care about my feelings or anything like that. They just came to me and say, you don't work here anymore.
Okay, so strong support from Republicans, but you said a majority of Americans don't feel this way necessarily. Where is Trump struggling the most right now?
Well, he's lost some support from independent voters. Nearly two-thirds agreed Trump's decisions are rushed. You know, Richard Pattison of Tennessee is in that camp. He's a registered Republican, but says he put down independent on our survey because he's anti-Trump.
The means are important as well as the end. I don't like the way that things are being done, and I am very concerned about the executive branch growing in power.
And he told me he supports, you know, cutting government spending and waste, but says the way Trump is doing it is alarming.
And Pierre's Elena Moore, thank you.
Thanks.
And just to recap, Trump's speech is set to start at 9 p.m. Eastern time tomorrow night. NPR's live special coverage and analysis of the president's joint address and the Democratic response will also begin at 9 Eastern. You can tune in on your local public radio station or in the NPR app and watch live in-studio video coverage at npr.org.
Healthcare workers around the country are attending crash courses on constitutional law. They are preparing for encounters with immigration and customs enforcement officers who are now officially allowed inside healthcare facilities for the first time. Jackie Fortier with our partner KFF Health News has the story.
Walking in the door at a St. John's Community Health Clinic in South LA, the waiting room is bustling with patients. But community health worker Anna Ruth Varela is worried that it's about to become a lot quieter. Patients are afraid to leave their homes.
The other day I spoke with one of the patients, says, I don't know if she'll go to my appointment to cancel. I don't know what to do.
Patients are hesitating to get care because they now fear they could be arrested inside the clinic. For years, a long-standing policy prevented federal immigration agents from making arrests at or near sensitive locations, including schools, places of worship, and health centers. But the policy was rolled back in January, just hours after Donald Trump's inauguration.
So that's when I learned that, hey, you know, we may, you know, exactly be a target. I thought we had more time.
Clinic administrator Darren Harris is racing to teach hundreds of St. John's health workers how to read warrants instead of intake forms.
Before ICE arrests, the one rule is silence is golden. Let's say that together. Silence is golden.
People in the U.S. without legal status have always been at risk of arrest. But now that agents can come through the clinic doors at any time, Harris tells the health workers they need to know their constitutional rights and teach their patients.
So what if ICE comes to St. John's?
Staff have a lot of other questions. Can they warn patients if ICE is in the building? Can agents go into exam rooms? Matt Lopez has some of those answers. He's director of state advocacy for the National Immigration Law Center.
If immigration officers want to enter private spaces or access private information at a healthcare center, they have to have a warrant signed by a judge.
But Lopez says this is uncharted territory for health clinics.
We don't have a track record to be able to know what a raid at a healthcare center looks like.
So he's advising clinics to double down on training staff.
It's incredibly important that every healthcare center has somebody who is trained to be able to read those warrants, to be able to read that they are valid or not.
Up in the San Francisco Bay Area, Zenadia Aguilera is that person for La Clinica. If ICE shows up, she's on call to rush over. She'll head to one of the 31 community clinics across three counties to verify that the warrants are legitimate. Aguilera is also taking on the burden of training all the staff. She's not even a quarter of the way done.
I feel really tired. We have about probably 1,000 more staff, so the majority of the work is still yet to happen.
California has close to 2 million unauthorized residents. She's afraid the state will be a focus of immigration enforcement.
We would like to stay agnostic, and we would like to just do the work of caring for our patients.
The only thing health clinics can do for now, she says, is be prepared for immigration agents to walk through the door.
That was reporter Jackie Fortier with our partner, KFF Health News.
A team of Palestinian and Israeli filmmakers won this year's Oscar for Best Documentary. Palestinians called it a morale boost. Israel's culture minister called it a sad moment for the world of cinema. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
And the Oscar goes to No Other Land.
The documentary tells the story of Palestinian and Israeli activist filmmakers fighting Israeli demolitions of Palestinian homes on lands Israel deems a military training zone. It follows the story of Israeli Yuval Abraham and Palestinian Basil Adra, who spoke at the Oscars.
About 2 months ago, I became a father, and my hope to my daughter that she will not have to live the same life I'm living now, always fearing.
Adra lives in a rural community in the Israeli-occupied West Bank that has faced repeated attacks by soldiers and settlers. We reached his neighbor, Mohammed Jabarin. 2 weeks ago, he says soldiers and settlers approached his home pointing guns. He's proud of the Oscar win. He says, this film really means a lot to us. It uplifts our spirits and helps us move forward with confidence. Israel's conservative culture minister, Miki Zohar, says the Oscar win is a sad moment for the world of cinema. On Israeli radio, he said the film amplifies narratives that distort Israel's image. No Other Land did not get any Israeli public funding. But weeks ago, Israel changed the way it offers public grants to filmmakers, minimizing funding for independent films. He said it was to prevent support for films like this one. Roni Abulafia, head of the Israeli Documentary Forum, calls the culture minister's comments shameful.
We as a filmmaker community in Israel are facing challenges regarding free speech, and we're trying to continue to tell the Israeli story without fear and without looking away.
The film also highlights the friendship between the Palestinian and Israeli filmmakers.
We made this film, Palestinians and Israelis, because together our voices are stronger.
Israeli Yuval Abraham called for the end of Israeli destruction during the war in Gaza, for the liberation of Israeli hostages taken by Hamas October 7, 2023, and for equality for Palestinian co-filmmaker Basil Adra.
Can't you see that we are intertwined? That my people can be truly safe if Basil's people are truly free and safe? There is another way.
Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. In her new memoir, the gymnast Jordan Chiles describes her journey from a hyperactive kid who couldn't talk unless she was bouncing around the house to a two-time Olympian decorated with gold and silver medals. But reaching such heights in gymnastics was never a sure thing. She writes that in her mid-teens, she thought seriously about quitting the sport until a pivotal conversation with her friend and fellow gymnast Simone Biles at a training camp in Florida.
So I was like, you know what? Maybe this isn't for me. And she came to me and she was like looking at me and she was like, Jordan, like, you have the talent, you have the gift. If you want to do it, go do it. If not, then, you know, continue on with your life. So I did take that to heart. I was like, my idol who I'm rooming with just told me that I have the potential and the capability of making an Olympic team. So I should really go for that. I wasn't seeing the full potential of who Jordan Chiles could be.
Chiles went on to medal in Tokyo and Paris. But last year's Olympics were also a major source of anguish for her when the bronze medal she earned in the women's floor routine was stripped away by an arbitration court on technical grounds. She details all of those ups and downs in her book, I'm That Girl, Living the Power of My Dreams. And when we spoke last week, she told me about the early days of her gymnastics career and how her hairstyles on the mat helped her express her identity, but also drew undue scrutiny from those around her.
I had braids, I had different twists, I had an afro, I had a lot of different things that you wouldn't typically see in gymnastics. And so I think it's really cool to have that ability to recognize that and continue to show that that is my personality. I'm always going to do something that feels comfortable with who I am and that's authentic to who I am.
Jordan, there's this story that you share about your hair in this book that I have to be honest, it made me incredibly upset, frankly. When I read it, you were 12, you went to this training camp in Texas and you were there with your former coach and your hair had been freshly braided. And your coach, she said it wasn't, if I remember correctly, the elite international look. So she takes you into the bathroom, as you write, and cut your hair, not just the extensions that were part of your braids, but your actual hair. And it just sounded so painful the way you described it. Can you take us back to that moment and tell us what you were feeling?
During that time, I couldn't really do that much as being a gymnast because I had to abide by the rules, not being disobedient or just not talking back because, you know, a lot of people say as a woman of color, that's basically as having an attitude problem.
Right.
But now when I think about it, I wish I used my voice. I told, you know, people that, you know, especially my coach, that that's not right. This is my hair. This is something that I embrace. And this is something that you just took away from me. Like, I'm not always going to look the same as every typical gymnast that people see. So I think just I started to embrace a lot more things. And that's when I started to figure out my personality a little more.
And I mean, that's one of the things that I think for those of us who have watched your career for all these years know and see is just how much of your fun, your personality shines through in every interaction. I guess I just wonder, this was one awful moment, one insult, but it feels like it came sort of at the top of this mountain of overt insults and microaggressions directed at you as you were just a kid who was trying to do your best and be your best. How did you stay so clear-eyed and find your way out of that and keep going?
I could tell you from the age of 12 to 16, I wasn't cleared mind. I wasn't any of those things. I felt like I always describe it as being in a box. So, you know, the things that I would do is just lean on my support system, whether it's my family, whether it's my teachers in school, whether it was, you know, friends, whether it was God himself and trying just to navigate life at that rate, because at the end of the day, I just knew I had a talent and I had a gift that wasn't, you know, something I should shy away from and that I should embrace.
I want to turn now to the Paris Olympics and this moment that we all saw when you, your teammate and friend Simone Biles, and Brazil's Rebeca Andrade were on that podium together. It was incredibly significant, no matter what came later with regards to the controversy over the medal. I just want to ask you to take us through what that moment felt like for you, what that was like. That was the last night of gymnastics competition.
So I'm jumping for joy. I'm like, yes, woohoo! Like, I just got my first event final medal. Like, this is great. I'm in awe. It's time to go put on, you know, our medal ceremony outfits and everything. And a lot of people have told me that I'm known to make history moments throughout my career. So I was just like, wow, this is another history moment that I get to add to, you know, my book. I even got to go to Paris, Disney Paris, the next day. Like, I was enjoying life, literally just enjoying life, embracing the moment.
You've talked about this incredible highlight, and yet you also write about coming from this huge celebratory point in your life to feeling this complete desolation as you were learning that your bronze medal had been revoked. I'm hoping you can just tell us what happened next.
I was devastated. I was crying. I felt like every single time I would accomplish something, something would be stripped away from me. And I could, you know, at a part of my book, I do explain that the same thing happened to me at a younger age where I got an award and it got stripped away from me at a young age. So to me, it was like a full circle moment. My life had kind of spiraled. Oh, Jesus, I didn't want to cry today, but it was just a very hard moment. And I never knew that I was going to have to go through that.
Yeah. I know that some time has passed since all of this has been unfolding, but how are you taking care of yourself now as you allow your team, your lawyers, others in your corner to continue to push for that bronze medal?
I have been doing the best that I can on my end. So now I get to just focus on being a UCLA student athlete, competing with my team, having a lot of fun, you know, in California, going to the beach, going shopping, doing all those things as a typical, you know, 23-year-old would do, and just enjoy being a dog mom and a best friend. So I've really just found ways to keep my mental in the best place as possible.
I have to ask, Jordan, what's next for you? I mean, it feels like the 2028 Summer Olympics in LA are just around the corner. As you mentioned, you are an UCLA student athlete. How large are the 2028 games looming in your thinking? How are you feeling?
They're up there. I'm not going to say they're really, really big. I think right now my biggest thing is just finishing these next few years of college and then going to see. It's not a yes, but it's not a no.
All right. I do want to ask you, though, I mean, you've done so much. You have created this incredible legacy. You've had this incredible history. You've done so much as a part of Team USA. How do you feel about the mark that you yourself have made on the sport?
I feel like I've made a huge mark. You know, people always say Simone's changed the game of gymnastics, and I feel like I've changed the culture of gymnastics. Who would have thought a girl would have this many tattoos, who would have lashes, who would have long nails, who would do crazy things or even dance on the side or get interaction with the crowd. I think it's really cool that I've been able to change that perspective of what gymnastics is supposed to be like.
We've been talking with Jordan Childs. She is the author of the new book, I'm That Girl. Jordan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is NPR News.
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's third novel, Americana, made a splash when it appeared in 2013. Then life happened. Children were born, parents died. Fiction writing seemed to stop until now.
Having finally finished a novel feels as though I am reunited with myself.
Hear about her new novel, Dream Count, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, if the penny goes away, will anyone miss it?
Sometimes they'll say, well, gee, this is a 1914 penny. It's got to be worth some money. Well, no, it doesn't. Just because they're old doesn't mean they're worth anything.
Plus, why some hairstylists have had it with AI.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. And a new development since his unprecedented Oval Office meeting with the president of Ukraine, President Trump has ordered a pause on aid to Ukraine. A White House official says the aid is being reviewed to assure it's making a contribution to a peaceful outcome in the Ukraine-Russia war. Earlier today, the president said four prime ministers and five presidents had called him since his meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky Friday. And in London, after a weekend summit with European leaders, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer told his House of Commons,
"The United Kingdom, France and our allies will work closely with Ukraine on a plan to stop the fighting, which we will then discuss directly with the United States."
Starmer declared that Ukraine must be at the table when discussing its future. A Boston-based civil rights advocacy organization is suing the Trump administration over its efforts to revoke legal status for many Haitian and Venezuelan immigrants. Sarah Betancourt of member station GBH reports.
The Boston area has one of the largest Haitian immigrant populations in the U.S. Many of them have temporary protected status. Marion Albert is a senior attorney for Lawyers for Civil Rights, representing plaintiffs in the suit.
The Trump administration's attempt to cut short TPS protections is unlawful, so our lawsuit will make clear that presidents do not have unchecked power to dismantle humanitarian protections, and we will also be seeking a preliminary injunction.
The lawsuit argues Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem doesn't have the authority to vacate extensions of temporary protected status granted under former President Biden. The Department of Homeland Security did not respond to a request for comment. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Betancourt in Boston.
The Dow lost 649 points today. This is NPR News in Washington. Pope Francis experienced new breathing crises today and is back on non-invasive ventilation, according to the Vatican. NPR's Ruth Sherlock has the latest.
Pope Francis's overall breathing function had been improving, but in the latest update, the Vatican says he's suffered two new episodes of acute respiratory crisis caused by a significant accumulation of mucus. The statement says Pope Francis then underwent two bronchoscopies to try to remove the mucus secretions. He then received non-invasive mechanical ventilation. Pope Francis has been hospitalised for over 2 weeks. He's begun signing off on official documents as from Gemelli Polyclinic in an indication that he has spent time up and working. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau today met with Britain's King Charles, with President Trump's repeated comments about annexation of Canada expected to be a point of conversation between the two. The king is the official head of state in Canada, which is a member of the Commonwealth. Britain's monarchs are to be politically neutral, but there are concerns in Canada the head of state should reinforce the notion of Canadian sovereignty and independence. Meanwhile, Charles has invited Trump to a state visit, and British Prime Minister Keir Starmer today insisted the U.S. and Britain have the closest of relationships. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station.
And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump is once again promising to impose 25% tariffs on goods from Canada and Mexico and to hike tariffs on Chinese imports as well starting Tuesday. Here's the president this afternoon.
No room left for Mexico or for Canada. No, the tariffs, they're all set. They go into effect tomorrow.
But he still didn't give any other details. We don't yet know the full scope of how the tariffs will affect different industries, but to help give us a sense of one of them, we're joined now by NPR's Camila Domonoske, who covers the car industry. Hi there.
Hi.
So Camila, start by telling us, what would these tariffs mean for car prices?
Well, it would mean they would go up. Vehicle prices are already quite high, of course, averaging about $48,000. That is up a lot since before the pandemic and clearly out of reach for many car buyers. But the tariffs would increase the cost not only of vehicles imported from Canada or Mexico, but the cost of building cars in the U.S. In extreme cases, it might go up by more than $10,000 per vehicle for particularly affected models, according to the Anderson Economic Group. Now, companies can try to reduce that impact by stockpiling parts or moving where they make things, or they might just absorb some costs. But multiple analysts do predict that consumers will see car prices go up by some $3,000 on average from these proposed tariffs. And that's not just these tariffs. That is just these tariffs, excuse me, not counting other tariffs that have been proposed.
Okay, so why is the auto industry so vulnerable to these tariffs?
Right. It's because the auto supply chain in North America is what's called highly integrated, which means that vehicle factories in all three countries, the U.S. and Canada and Mexico, they ship things back and forth. In fact, one part can cross borders repeatedly in the manufacturing process, like a wire that's made in the U.S. and then bundled together with other wires in Mexico, shipped back to the U.S. to go into a seat, which might go to Canada to go into a car. Ford CEO Jim Farley has been very blunt about what this means for the impacts of these Canadian and Mexican tariffs. He said this last month at an investor conference.
Let's be real honest. Long term, a 25% tariff across the Mexico and Canadian border will blow a hole in the U.S. industry that we have never seen.
Blow a hole in the U.S. auto industry. And here's the thing, Juana. This afternoon, President Trump said that automakers will just have to build car plants in the U.S. to avoid these tariffs. But Ford already makes vehicles in the U.S. They make more vehicles in the U.S. than any other automaker. But because these parts cross borders, they would still be hurt a lot by these tariffs. In fact, hurt much more than automakers overseas.
The tariffs that start tomorrow are on goods from Canada, Mexico, and China. But are there other proposed tariffs that the auto industry is also anxious about?
Yeah, I mean, there's a slew of them, right? More tariffs have been proposed on other specific countries. Higher tariffs on steel and aluminum are kicking in this month. Obviously, those are crucial raw materials for cars. And there might be additional tariffs just for cars. And automakers might hope that tariffs would go away soon, but they just don't know, in part because Trump's stated goals for these tariffs are often contradictory. If the goal is to use them as leverage for negotiating border enforcement, then maybe they'll be revoked as soon as Trump says a goal is met. But if the goal is to promote U.S. jobs or raise revenue, then, well, you might assume those tariffs would be around a long time. So car companies are left with a lot to navigate, and it's really hard to plan when the future is uncertain.
That's NPR's Camila Domonoske. Thank you.
Thank you.
On April 1st, voters in Wisconsin will go to the polls to pick a state Supreme Court justice. It's the kind of race that normally would not get much attention, but it's a race that could offer some clues about the upcoming 2026 election cycle and about Elon Musk's power in politics. NPR senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson has more.
On the airwaves in Wisconsin, it sounds like a typical race. Republicans are bashing the Democratic candidate on crime.
Susan Crawford had one job, keep a convicted rapist behind bars. Yet Crawford didn't bother filing the appeal in time, letting the rapist walk free.
And the Democrats are attacking the Republican on abortion.
When I was pregnant, I had complications. But because of the ban, doctors couldn't help me. Brad Schimmel has no idea what it's like to lay in a hospital bed, pregnant and dying.
But this battle for a seat on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court is no ordinary race. It's the first race of the 2026 cycle with national implications. That's because the race will determine the balance of power on the state court, which will not only decide issues like abortion, but could determine whether congressional district maps maintain the current big Republican advantage or are redrawn to reflect Wisconsin's half-red and half-blue population. Off-year races like this one are like canaries in the coal mine. Long before the midterm elections, they'll be examined for answers to a bunch of political questions, such as, will the abortion rights side win again, as it has in almost every state race since Roe v. Wade was overturned? Another big one is about the Democrats, who are still reeling from their defeat in November and struggling to raise money. Ben Wickler is the chairman of the Wisconsin State Democratic Party.
The fundamental question in this race will be whether Democrats have the fighting spirit to turn out in the numbers that are needed to demonstrate that they are still in the game. So many Democrats went into the fetal position after Trump won. And the question is, can we get up off the mat?
And there's something else brand new in this race. Elon Musk. After spending close to $300 million to elect Donald Trump, Musk, one of the richest men on the planet, is pouring money into the Wisconsin court race, according to ad tracking data and campaign finance reporting. We reached out to Musk's super PAC, Building America's Future, but didn't get a response. Ian Vandewalker of the Brennan Center for Justice says big donors on both sides are nothing new, but Musk is a different order of magnitude.
One of the biggest spenders ever in American history and the most willing to get involved in politics. And I think it does call attention to the power of a single individual who has his own business interests, his own political agenda.
While Musk's billions are intimidating, Ben Wickler thinks they might not be a guaranteed benefit for Republicans.
One thing that's so striking about Musk getting involved in this race is that, as he's done with our national politics, he's making this about himself. That energizes Democrats. This is something that could backfire on the GOP.
At least that's what Democrats in Wisconsin are hoping.
If the Democrats in this state want to pin their race for the Supreme Court on Elon Musk, go right ahead.
That's Brian Schimming, chair of the Wisconsin Republican State Party. To him, Elon Musk's money is a powerful boost for Republicans.
If Elon Musk wants to spend time and effort and treasure in Wisconsin, we would most certainly welcome it.
Ian Vandewalker says Musk's involvement could cut both ways, kind of like Trump, who motivates people to come out and vote for him and against him.
Does he turn into a political third rail, or is he a hero to one side and a villain to the other, or is he sort of neutral? I think we're still seeing how that's going to play out.
Right now, Elon Musk is the most powerful man in the country other than Donald Trump. And the Wisconsin State Supreme Court race could reveal whether Musk's virtually unlimited bank account is a silver bullet for Republicans, or whether Musk himself and his chainsaw cuts to the federal government have become a liability. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Lagos is Africa's most populous city, known for its vibrant energy, business, and culture. It's also infamous for its brutal traffic jams. Officials say trains are a key part of the solution. The first intercity metro line has been open for over a year now, built with support from China. But has it made a difference? NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu battled the traffic to find out.
In the morning rush hour in Lagos, I find myself in a familiar place, stuck in traffic. The cars are bumper to bumper, drivers jerking forward into small pockets of space. For most of the 20 million people in this city, this is a daily reality. The average person here spends up to 6 hours of their day stuck in traffic, according to some estimates. But while Lagos's population has rapidly grown, the pace of new roads and new transport links has been painfully slow. But over the last few years, the government has raised hopes that change is on the way. And from the stress of the congestion, I arrive in the cool hall of the Marina train station. I head onto the Lagos Blue Line, a 13-kilometer rail journey connecting Lagos Island, a commercial hub in the heart of the city, to the western part of Lagos. This is one of two new train lines hailed by government officials as part of a rail revolution. As the train departs, there's music, there's Wi-Fi, and Premier League soccer highlights play on small screens along the carriage walls. The novelty of this is still so clear. Some passengers take selfies and pictures of the Lagos skyline.
It's been wonderful, comfortable, nice.
One of them is Jeff Osamu, a doctor taking the train on his daily commute to work.
So if you can afford it, I think it's the best way to go.
This metro has been a long time coming. Plans for an intercity rail line were first drawn up more than 40 years ago, in the 1980s, but it repeatedly stalled, until there was an intervention from China.
Lagos is a great city, great economic center.
The Chinese ambassador to Nigeria, Chu Jianshun, spoke at the official opening after China stepped in to complete the project with a major investment. But a year on, the question is, has it really made a difference?
So this is your first time taking the train?
One of the passengers on the train is 53-year-old Oluwayinka Peter. He says he enjoys taking the train. It's cheaper than taking a bus or a boat and cuts his journey time by half. But he says most people don't find it useful because it's poorly planned. He and I are among just over a dozen passengers thinly spread around the carriage. These trains were projected to serve 150,000 passengers a day, and so far it's less than 10,000. Most potential passengers find it tough to reach many of the stations, as they've been built far away from existing transport links like buses. So they're complicated to reach, and when you get off the train, it's hard to get to where you're going. The train carriages fill up by the time the journey ends, but when it stops, there's a stampede. Dozens of people rush to get one of the few small buses waiting to take them to their final stop, because if they miss it, there's a long wait until the next one. And when it finally comes, we're all back where we started, thrown into the Lagos gridlock again. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. From AI chatbots to AI romantic partners, artificial intelligence is infused all through our tech culture, right? And now people are bringing pictures of AI creations to med spas, salons, even bridal shops, asking vendors, designers, and stylists to bring these AI images to life. Well, business owners are saying these pictures create a totally false sense of what is even in the realm of possibility. Washington Post internet culture reporter Tatum Hunter wrote all about this and joins us now. Hi, Tatum.
Hi.
Okay, so give us just a couple examples that really struck you where, you know, like some client sought out some service with an AI image in mind and the expectation was just totally defying reality.
I called a lot of small business owners for this story, and I think my favorite example was an event planner in Ohio who had a bride-to-be approach her with some inspo for her upcoming wedding she had found on the internet and that was generated by AI. Uh-huh. And the scene in the image was trees growing out of the floor, you know, these luxury green emerald linens draped over the wedding tables, sprawling flower arrangements, you know, perfect Hollywood lighting. And the event planner said that she was just dumbstruck because it looked like the Met Gala and would have taken hundreds of thousands of dollars to reproduce.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is how are these consumer expectations affecting the bottom line? Like, are people walking out the door and basically saying to these vendors, well, if you don't have the skills to replicate this, then I'll just find someone who can? Like, is that what is happening right now?
I heard multiple instances where people lost out on what they felt could have been business for them because of this type of awkward run-in. That event planner said that, you know, she could have made, you know, a $30,000 check doing the wedding for that bride if, maybe perhaps if that AI image hadn't come into play. Also spoken with a wedding dress designer who had a client walk out when she, you know, couldn't get the dress that she wanted. The dress was this floor-length white gown, and it had no straps, and it had no back. And when the designer said to
How does it stay on?
Yeah, she said, well, this, you know, this is beautiful, but it's not going to stay on your body. But that wasn't good enough for that person.
There are ways that you just haven't thought of. A lot of tape. Okay, the thing is, people have long wanted to look like the unreal thing they see in an airbrushed or a color-enhanced photo. But is there something different about now with the growth of AI? Like, do people seem even more delusional, more demanding about their hopes and dreams?
So I think that on one hand, this is just another step in the, you know, evolution of how we imagine what we want as consumers and, you know, perhaps in a consumeristic culture. But on another hand, it's different because this stuff doesn't necessarily have a basis in reality, even though the models are trained on, you know, images that I'm sure include real photographs of something like a wedding space. We are giving people the power to ask for something that that isn't real. We struggle as a culture with our narrow standards of beauty. Then it's easy to see in this instance how AI has further narrowed and kind of amped things up because of the just preponderance of this slop on the internet and how much of it we're seeing.
That is Washington Post internet culture reporter Tatum Hunter. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
People who collect things, stamps, records, trading cards, look at the world a little differently than the rest of us. Why does that one misprint on the label make that vinyl record worth $500? Why is one Pokemon card worth thousands more than some other card? It's collectors who hold the answers to these questions. And with the news that President Trump wants to get rid of pennies, NPR's Andrew Limbong stopped by one coin collecting shop to find their reaction.
In just a few weeks, members of the numismatic community, that is, coin collectors, will be coming into Baltimore for the big Whitman Coin Expo. They'll be buying, selling, trading, grading coins and paper money of all types, and so I figured here, of all places, would the death of the penny mean something, that it'll be the talk of the town, or at least a heated topic of debate?
Absolutely not. Nobody's going to care one way or another.
That's Philip Sager. He's planning on going to the expo like he always does. He owns Geezer's Tweezers. It's a shop just outside of Baltimore City that deals in rare and collectible coins and stamps. He's been at this location for more than 30 years.
Do people ever come in thinking, with pennies particularly, like, oh, I got something here?
Oh, yeah, every day. Sometimes they'll say, well, gee, this is a 1914 penny. It's got to be worth some money. Well, no, it doesn't. Just because they're old doesn't mean they're worth anything.
He says everyone's got piles of pennies laying around in jars and cans and boxes, including, of course, Sager. He takes me to a room in the back where he's got pennies laying around in cardboard boxes, and he hands me a couple.
Well, this is an old penny, but that's a large penny.
It's about the size of a quarter.
And that's what pennies looked like in the 1830s and 20s and 40s. Here's a better one. This is 1859. Nice Indian head penny. It says 1 cent.
On the other side, it's got what looks like a woman wearing a headdress. It hits me that I'm holding history in my hand right now. A big penny from the 1830s and an Indian head penny from 1859. They've been around for a long time and have seen more than I ever will, but even to expert coin collectors, these pennies aren't worth much. They're bouncing around in loose cardboard boxes in rough shape. If Sager sold them both, it probably amounts to the cost of an okay lunch. And as if to drive that point home, as Sager is showing me other pennies, I realize that I don't have the Indian head penny in my hand anymore.
Here's an interesting coin. Here, it's a 2019, so it's only 5 years old.
Oh, wait, I think I dropped the Indian head.
Oh, it was right there, right?
No, this is the big one. Did I give you back the Indian head?
Yeah, I guess we did. Oh, it's somewhere.
It's somewhere, he says. As if to say, it's not a big deal if it's lost. And maybe it's not a big deal if the penny as a currency ceases to exist. We as consumers have cash, credit cards, Venmo, Apple Pay to buy stuff. Collectors have tons of other cool coins to buy and trade. And I know, Sager said, just because something is old doesn't mean it has inherent value. But it will be the end of a hundreds-year-long run for the penny, which has got to be worth something. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/iulab. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. And from the John D.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.